Blog Talk Radio. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The United Nations is calling for the release of leaders detained in the military coup in Sudan on Monday. Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and his cabinet were arrested after the army dissolved the transitional government and declared a state of emergency. Protests have broken out in the capital, Khartoum, according to media reports. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the takeover in a post on Twitter and called for the Prime Minister and other officials to be released immediately. There must be full respect for the constitutional charter to protect the hard-won political transition, he wrote. Military and civilian leaders had been sharing power in Sudan, which has been on a path to democratic transition over the past 2 years, following the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. Volker Perthes, head of the UN political mission supporting the transition, UNITAMS, also condemned the coup. He issued a statement urging parties to exercise utmost restraint and called for an immediate return to dialogue and engagement. Meanwhile, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warned the coup risked jeopardizing important progress made towards democracy and respect for human rights. In expressing her strong condemnation, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said, "It would be disastrous if Sudan goes backwards after finally bringing an end to decades of repressive dictatorship. What the country needs is to move forward and consolidate democracy," she added, something which the Sudanese people have expressed countless times before. Ms. Bachelet also called for internet and mobile services to be restored. She reminded military and security forces to refrain from unnecessary use of force and to respect the rights of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. Moving to Afghanistan, where a record 22.8 million people, more than half the population, are facing acute hunger. That's according to the latest food security report released by humanitarian partners co-led by UN agencies, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, and the World Food Programme, WFP. Afghans have been severely affected by the combined impacts of drought, conflict, the COVID-19 pandemic, and economic crisis, they said. The report comes ahead of the harsh winter season, which threatens to cut off areas of the country where families depend on aid to survive the freezing months. To meet increasing needs, WFP says it will require as much as $220 million per month, while FAO is seeking $11.4 million in urgent funding for humanitarian response and a further $200 million for the agricultural season into 2022. Deanne Penn, UN News.
our show in just a few minutes. The weather here is taking a brisk turn to the cold. I'm telling you, we got wind all over the place. West Coast has a cyclone, I guess some sort of cyclonic boom. I don't know what the hell they're calling it out there. They're getting flooded. And the East Coast, Northeast, is supposed to be having what they call out there a nor'easter. And John Grant's on the phone. He's in the Northeast, roughly, on the day.
It's not a big rainstorm. We just had some rain. It hasn't been a lot here, but I guess, it's sweeping in the whole area with some rain. I guess you call that a nor'easter. But this is a rather mild one, at least in our spot. So, but it's getting cooler.
Good.
Fall is here for sure.
Yeah, that's happening here, too. It's evening, mornings, morning crack of dawn, 40, 45 degrees.
We got to get our, we got a couple of tropical plants out there we got to get in and things like that.
I know, we've got that too, and she does it, I won't do it. And because I just said, well, let them freeze to death. You know, we'll bring them back tomorrow. Bring them back next.
So you don't
because
have a green
so
thumb.
Big. I mean, she's right. got she's got some that are like she explains to me that these plants are like 30 years old. They're, some of these plants are older than our marriage. And I go, oh, okay. So we have to.
Well, you got to nurture those babies, you know, hey?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of them, I said, well, why can't we trim them? Because one of them is about 4 foot high and 5 feet wide. It's really, literally a tree, I think, of some sort.
What is
you know?
It?
And,
what kind of plant is it?
I don't know. It has these little waxy leaves on them. I don't know. And it has it's not reed. I mean, it's wood, literally wood, you know, woody.
Okay.
But it has these wax cover. I don't know what. It's a ginkgo tree. I don't know what it is.
Oh,
I'll ask her.
Well, we had a huge night-blooming cirrus, I guess you call it, we had in Florida. We had, they'd climb the pine trees, and they'd bloom at night. We got 15 blooms at once sometimes, you know. But here we had a tropical, subtropical plant. So it was getting rather big, and I'm getting rather old. So we decided to give it away so I don't have to haul in and get a goddamn hernia every fall, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Although I did note that she got my box. I mean, I know. But I did note she brought my Boston fern in, which I bought about 5-6 years ago. I bought two of them to go out on the front porch, and you know, and I expected them to die, you know, and buy new ones next year, you know.
So you don't have a very green thumb, I guess. So.
Well, I have a very lazy thumb is what I have, you know. So
there you go. Yeah. I
use it for typewriters and picking my nose, and that's about it. So,
there you go.
You got to have a thumb to typewrite, you know.
All right.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I noticed. Yeah. So we're saving some of our outdoor plants to become indoor plants, and now my place looks like a botanical garden. And I told her, I said, just pick up the big damn dead leaves, will you please? I mean, I just get tired of it, you know. They're picking up after the plants and the cats and the dogs. So
right.
I mean, it gets
flora
but
and fauna.
The weather's getting. Yeah, right. Yeah. All here in my under my roof. But you know, what is it? Animals would be fauna. No, flora. The flora, the wild
flora.
Yeah, flora
is plants, and animals, your dogs, would be the fauna, yeah, I guess.
Oh, no, well, we want to talk about animals. Fauna, the fauna of D.C. I mean, the animals of Washington, D.C., that's what.
Oh.
I don't know if I've got
savage
it.
Savage animals. Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, well, are there either liars, crooks, politicians, lobbyists, and then deluded. Literally delusional kind of crazy people. I mean, it's sort of amazing to read about them in the press. I don't know what the New York Times has got on the top headline.
The top right is Democrats push for budget deal as rifts persist. So that hard-nosed tough guy from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, has... You know, and Christian Sinema are holding out. And so I gather big bill, the $3.5 trillion bill, has now been whittled down to either $2 trillion or $1.75 trillion or, you know, whatnot. As Everett Dirksen said, you know, a billion here, a billion there. After a while, you're talking about real money, you know.
This is what it's over 10 years. What they're talking about—that is a long time,
right? Of course,
in today's I mean, I think it's ridiculous because they're not saying that enough, if you ask me. Look, this is 10 years, you know, spread out over 10 years. And,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I'm just fed up with the way
the Democrats and the news media, frankly, assume that everybody knows that, and they don't. I ran that by some of my Republican friends, you know, and it's like, well, I didn't realize that. I said, yeah, I mean, that's not a lot of money, even on a yearly basis. And they're not even really raising taxes like they should on the rich, you know. I mean,
you have to look at it, and of course this is people aren't inclined to do this because people want what they want and they want it now and all kinds of things like that. They want it absolute. They don't want any compromise. But I mean, what's happening now? It seems to me on a larger, longer historical level that, you know, the right wing ascendancy has been going on since the mid 70s. And it's reached, you know, the cartoon level of Donald Trump that, you know, basically it's approaching fascism. Yeah. And so the pendulum is, you know, to the right. And whether the pendulum, you know, America kind of historically has hewn to the center almost like gravity. After a while, it, you know, goes to extremes a little bit. But it just, I don't know, just as the way I look at it, it hews to the center. And so if the pendulum is going to the right, that's, you know, that it's, if it's reached its sort of extreme, you know, the natural tendency is the pendulum will swing back and then, you know, hewing towards the center. So it seems to me that's what's happening here, that we've got Joe Biden who's, you know, catering to the progressives, trying to be the FDR of the 21st century here. And so it's, you know, it's like the pendulum moved to the right in an incremental fashion from the mid-70s, so it moves back in an incremental fashion. It's not going to, you know, it's going to be slower than many of us hope. But if incrementalism is really happening here, that, you know, this will be a beginning, and then we'll get more and more of that stuff. The climate change stuff that they knock out now, they better put in later. So I don't know. That's the way I look at it. That basically this is a shifting. You know, as Obama said, a third reconstruction. It's things are shifting, and it takes a while. Like the cliche metaphor is you can't turn a super tanker or one of those giant container freighters on a dime. You know, it takes a while to make a left turn there. So, you know, that's what we're in the middle of, and it's going to take, God, it could take a decade or whatnot, you know. But I see it as a positive move, but who knows? We'll wait and see, you know.
Well, it's positive, but I don't know if it's positive enough to help the people that want to have that kind of change.
Well,
in
right.
2022
well, as I say,
or 2024.
This is the hardball politics that, you know, you just have to wait. Obviously, if I had my way or you had your way, you know, hey, you know, we'd have something completely different. You know, we have, you know, things would be operating much differently, but you know, there's 300 plus million people in this country, and a lot of them don't agree with us. So, you know, this is how it works, you know. And it's always unsatisfying, and like they said, you don't want to see how sausage and laws are made. You know, they're both disgusting processes. And we're going through one of those disgusting processes right now. Anyway, enough of that. I guess I'm just muttering here. But...
Well, no, I mean, it's just so disheartening that, you know, people really, you know, 8 million, what, six to 8 million pop votes for brought the guy in, largest number of people voted in the history of the country, I think, you know, and they beat Trump, and it sent a really big message, I think, to the country that, you know, we're ready for some big changes after you know, and I don't think on the cusp of the pandemic, you know, the economy tanked quickly. I think people have got it. I mean, they call it the Great Resignation, and enough of that. Now it's like, you know, they're tired. You know, people are just said, hey, you know, I'm not going to go back to work to a shitty job that I had with a shitty boss, you know, for shitty pay, you know. And, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, I think people are becoming more aware of their grassroots power.
Right. Well, this is all part of what I'm talking about. And there was a piece in the paper about this idea of, as you just alluded to, that people quitting their jobs, you know, that labor is demanding more respect. In other words, you can't treat us like shit. You have to treat working people with dignity and respect. And, you know, sometimes people are willing to give up the job for that. And apparently there's a lot of that going. I mean, some people blame the pandemic. you know, there are people who quit their jobs because they didn't want to take a vaccine, which I think is ridiculous. But, again, you know, it just indicates that people can, you know, have things that are more important to them than their labor job. You know, especially in a, you know, when you have, you know, the corporations and wealthy people running everything with, you know, the rise of robotics, and we need fewer and fewer people to work. You just need somebody to push the button and monitor the machines. You know, this dynamic is happening more and more, and, you know, so there has to be a new sort of relationship between capital and labor in this country, and, you know, the people who are rich and powerful don't want that to happen because they think, well, you know, we've assembled all our wealth and all our power, and now we can dictate whatever we want labor to do. Well, you know, labor has a voice, and
The service sector of the economy of employees in the service jobs, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, they're the first to leave, and they're cockroach capitalists that they worked for were the first ones to say, you know, well, they had their hand out with the federal government, and they got a lot of them got money, you know, to pay their keep their payroll going. It's called PPP. Right. Oh, I thought that was funny. And but a lot of people said, well, fuck, why should I in Kansas? You know, why should I come back as a waitress or a waiter at $2.25 an hour? That's the minimum wage for waiters and waitresses. You know, in Kansas. And never mind $7.25 an hour. I mean, that's federal. I mean, they don't even acknowledge that. I mean, I don't blame them for. You know, hey, screw you. I'm not coming back to your shitty job and your shitty pay.
Fuck that. And then, you know, then work out some gig scam where you don't even pay income tax or whatever, and, you know, you're off the books, and suddenly, you know, things aren't working like they used to be.
Get so many people off the books. 4.3 million. That's an official Bureau of Labor Standards number. 4.3 million resigned in the month of September. It's 2 million more than resigned the previous month. I mean, that's a lot of workers that are saying, you know, I'm not going to work at this place. You know, there's lots and lots of people. These capitalists, these especially the small ones, you think they were kings and queens, you know, they're so immodest, you know, in the way, you know, I'm a bit, count the number of them in January 6th that were there. They're almost all of them were cockroach capitalists. They were some little business fart. And everyone I know out here that I've talked to that has a marginal job, you know, they might make 15 an hour, maybe 13 an hour, you know, they don't get enough hours in on a weekly basis to be guaranteed health insurance.
Right,
so they
exactly have
to pay it themselves. I mean, it's,
oh well, that,
they
that
cut
you know that
corners.
Started yeah
this
that
whole,
started some decades
this whole
ago
shit,
the idea
this
of
whole,
yeah.
It began with Reagan. Some people neoliberals go back to Reagan, but yeah, I don't know. It's just this whole it's this whole cut corners.
Right.
You know, especially with working your labor bill, the labor bill at your business, this in time inventory, only make enough to supply the demand. You know, that's why you've got shortages right now in the country. It's because that and we're dependent on a lot of waste, crappy stuff. I mean, well-made stuff from China, but it can't get off the boat. Yeah, but really,
right. Well, I was wondering
how your brother
Mark's doing on his trekking, because they're talking now about bringing alien Mexicans in to be truck drivers and things like that. Yeah.
Well, they were already doing that, but it wasn't really Mexico. He told me he wasn't complaining. He just said that they were willing to be exploited more. People from the Philippines,
of course,
the Middle East. These people aren't. They don't mind smelling body odor and literally living in a truck cab, doing what they call in the industry team driving. That's where you get two or three people in the cab, and that thing just never stops.
24/7.
Right. The only time you stop is to fuel up to put more gas in it, and maybe shit in a bottle in the back or something. You know what I mean? Eat out of a microwave and don't shower or shave or anything. Just keep going. He said that, and he didn't like, they don't like that because it lowers the labor standards of other drivers, and it raises the expectations of what the employers can expect the other workers to do. So they don't really like that at all. But they're sort of a joke too. I mean, it's like
there are
racists who go after these people, racist truck drivers. Mark's not one of those, but Mark really he explains that to me, the concrete material reasons that people get angry in the truck business about that. He's changed, and now I'm happy to report he's semi-retired. They're treating him like an older guy now. I mean, they worked until he had to have major surgery. I mean, they really did. They pushed him as far as he could at 66.
Oh,
no, 64. And finally, they gave up and gave him a job where he's driving a city route truck, which he goes into. It goes into the Kansas City, the metropolitan area, on a route. He comes back at like 4:30. So he has a regular job now. He's not out driving overnight.
So he's not doing
cross
country.
No, he's real happy to get off that because of that reason when I just described the incredible pressure they put on you too.
Well, that's what you're talking about. I mean, the idea of part-time workers, gig workers, or whatever you want to call it, that you're moving these jobs into part-time or independent freelance sort of things where they don't have to, they don't have to give you any medical care or anything like that. They just, they keep the salaries low. And so, it's come to a head that, this isn't working in a society. You know, you have all these factors that mitigate against, the dignity of workers in many cases. Let alone just the salary issue, the dignity issues. And they have families and, they want to enjoy their lives rather than, work like a slave all day long for less and less money. There's so many people who, we were just talking yesterday, my neighbor, and she worked at a college, and they were piling more and more work on her, it ended up she was doing like what used to be three jobs. She was now doing it all herself. She had been there a long time. She's very efficient. She could do this. And so she finally got an offer somewhere else, and she moved on and said, why are you leaving? This is what you've been doing, And you can't just dump tasks on people, and you know, and they won't recognize what you're doing. Eventually, they're going to recognize what you're doing. You know, trying to get more and more, you know, squeeze more and more work out of these folks, but you're not, you know, giving them any greater dignity, or in fact, you're, you know, less dignity. And anyway, yeah.
Well,
and I think
that
comes
problem,
to a head, and it you get reactions, and you get the sort of responses, well, fuck it, I don't need this job. I'm sorry, I'll do something else. You know, I don't want to be treated like this anymore. And you know, the capitalists got to deal with that.
Yeah, and I'm glad they're trying. I'm glad they're whining about doing it. And
yeah,
let
them whine. Let them whine. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's John Deere and what's the Kellogg cereal. They're all their workers are on strike. I noticed that Bernie Sanders put out on his email list. I'm on it, and he's putting out 100% of what you donate today will go to the striking workers at John Deere. So if you'll give me $5, it'll go right to 100% will go to the striking workers at John Deere. So, I mean, and that's the kind of stuff I wanted to spread that out to people, because I think that it's that kind of solidarity that'll get these people through.
Yeah, absolutely.
The hardship of going on strike is not fun. I've been on twice in my life. And then
of course not.
It's not fun. You take a real economic hit. And you get desperate, and you're out on the picket line. You're watching these son of a bitches go in and take your job, basically do your job, you know. And it's not fun. It's a very demoralizing experience if you look at it from the perspective of someone who, you know, who are trying to make their job better, you know, and that you do all these negotiations. I've watched the union stewards and the representatives negotiate, and the companies. It's almost like a kabuki dance. You know, if you're out on the production line, you don't know from day to day what's going on with the plant manager until you see him come out of the office, the glass enclosed office, and come out and start yelling at you. Then you realize, well, they must be in negotiations, because you never see the plant manager until he comes out and yells at us. You know what I mean? Only maybe once every 6 months do you see that prick come out, and he's yelling at the foreman to yell at us about getting to drive the machines faster. No, that's a real thing. I mean, you get into that. You can figure that shit out by watching their body language. I mean, I understand. I think that's a good thing. But it's almost, with the way labor laws are written in the United States, it's almost suicidal. I hate to say that, but it's the truth. I mean, it's just really, it's really hardcore to go on strike in America, because the laws are written against it. I mean, they can hire
workers. Right. In the case you may in the end gain something, but you may have lost a lot as well. So, you know, even though you may get a little increase in salary or something from your strike, it's cost. There's a great cost to that. And I've never been on strike, so I don't know, but I certainly sympathize with unions.
Yeah, it's sort of the last ditch thing. There are many tactics that can be done, but not for this show. That you can do it to accelerate, make the boss negotiate a little quicker, but not for this show. But and the unions need to do that. They need to get more militant. You know, I mean.
Yeah, I really agree. Yeah.
But I mean, now we got Michael Moore. I'm on his list, and Michael Moore sent out an email just a few days ago. Let me see if I can find it. And it expressed something that I thought was interesting that you brought up.
Yeah.
At least you said that there were some of your more left-wing leaning friends of yours who brought this issue up about I don't, what do you call it? Insurrection Indy, I think is what Michael Moore called it.
Oh, did he? That's interesting. It, wow.
Yeah,
I've talked about that. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. You said some of your friends are sort of like, we should have thought of January 6th, you know, or something like that, you know. And
Go ahead. The reason the left doesn't think of that is because this is a fundamental problem that the left has vis-a-vis the right that we are dealing with, because the right is much more inclined and much more comfortable with the idea of violence. Let me ignore this. Whereas the left is, you know, we're anti-war, we're anti-violence, we're anti-police violence and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, we just want to get along. We want to cooperate. Instead of conflict, we want cooperation. You know, the fundamentals of socialism, of course, that boogeyman word. So the left is not inclined to be as hardball when it, you know, the right would, of course, disagree with that. They would quote Antifa or something and the riots in Seattle and things like that. But I think they're very different. I think that there's nothing. The left has done nothing like January 6th. My God, the left could not get away with January 6th. I mean, I think anybody who's aware knows that, you know, if a left anti-war demonstration or anti-police violence demonstration started doing things like that, like they did January 6th, you know, it just never would have gelled. It never would have happened because they would have been much more harsh dealing with it. And I think the reason that January 6th happened was that police and things like that do have a soft spot for the right. They, you know, and they sort of overlooked it, and oh, this and that, you know, because I get it from dealing with cops, you know, the cops here. I told them, when I called my chief, I said, when the Civil War comes, I'm not sure which side you're going to be on, and I mean that, you know. And so I think all of that, those kinds of thoughts and cautions really do apply. And so I can see some leftists do having some envy of that January 6th. Like, God, you know, they really, you know, made a big splash. But that's not the kind of splash I want to make, you know. So I don't know. You know, it's an interesting question. Well, where did Michael Moore say that?
It's on his Michael Moore. I subscribe to all of these. Right and
mm-hmm.
left,
okay.
Right wing, but it was on his e-newsletter.
Okay,
here's a little segment. It says, aside from the violence, aside from their despicable racism and misogyny,
right.
aside from the fact that we vehemently oppose everything they stand for, the truth is
right.
that deep down in your soul, as you watch what your eyes could not believe was happening, admit to me,
right.
that in that appalling moment on January 6th, 2021, you were, how do I say it, jealous that it was the fascists who had risen up and not us long before now.
Right.
Now, he says, again, not jealous of the unforgivable violence they unleashed. Rather, I'm suggesting that there is a small piece of you and me that has
right.
wished for just once in our lives we had
right.
that kind of courage, that resolve, that rage of conscience and commitment to just not effing put up with this shit any longer. And then he
wow,
goes on,
wow,
and
wow,
yeah,
wow.
we did not storm the, skipping a little bit, we did not storm the Pentagon in August of 1964 on the day after Lyndon Johnson lied to the American people, telling us that the Vietnamese had attacked one of our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Right.
And last
exactly.
week, Republican politicians in Texas declared their ownership of the reproductive organs of all women in Texas. We, the majority, did not rush to Austin, Texas, and nonviolently encircle the state capitol building, take down the Texas flag, and refuse
okay.
to leave until they removed their filthy hands from the bodies of 173 million American women they wish to control.
Right.
And he goes on about the Supreme Court being stacked against us. We should be surrounding the Supreme Court.
I thought of that myself. Why the hell aren't we having giant demonstrations outside the goddamn Supreme Court? Right, exactly.
I think he's
really onto something, Michael Moore, because the way it will, what this means to me is, you know, rumblings about this. Like you say, I said that. He's obviously said it very well.
Yeah.
What this means is that the left is questioning its own goody-two-shoes sort of posturing, you know. In other words, that we're so politically correct and everything must be nice, the cancel culture, the wokeness, and all this stuff that we love, that they love to ridicule the left about, you know. Enough of that. Look, you know, fuck identity culture, all that stuff. The left should assume its historic rights in the struggle between capital and labor, et cetera, and actually become much more serious than it is. And you don't want to fragment into identity politics squabbles within the left, which is, you know, going to destroy the left. You know, we do get lost and confused and distracted with all that kind of stuff. You know, the left loves to eat itself. It loves to fight amongst itself. You know, but the point is, you know, all of the abuses against, you know, women, against blacks, against gays, et cetera, against all the identity groups, you know, there's already laws, in most cases, to cover, you know, any abuse that these identity groups receive. The point is, so basically, these identity groups, what they're suggesting is they want to be treated just like white people or straight people or men. You know, The Constitution and the law systems already support that. So the point is to focus on that and to get, you know, rise all boats to figure out a structure that really does protect people's rights, no matter who they are, you know. I mean, that's easy to say, but, of course, what the Donald Trump phenomenon shows is that, you know, identity politics, you know, if you can't lick them, join them. And, you know, the reactionary white backlash has taken identity politics to a new level. And it, to me, makes it quite clear that, you know, that's not the way the left. Go, but I mean, you know, who am I? But the point is, what Michael Moore says is very interesting, because it seems to be saying to me, look, we got to reevaluate. We're too nice, or something. We're envious of this, but what does that mean? What that means to me is, the way I look at late January 6th is that the left has no choice in this struggle. The struggle of January 6th and domestic terrorism on the right and things like that, it has no choice but to defer to the deep state. In other words, the left is not going to go one-on-one and beat the right-wing domestic terrorism. It's just not going to do it because it has a monopoly on the Second Amendment. It has all the guns and everything. So the only people that are going to, the only elements that are going to check this right-wing, rising right-wing, you know, domestic terrorism stuff is the established deep state, which, of course, extreme left and extreme right both hate, you know. To me, that's the dilemma here. You know, I just saw something from the Green Party, and they're all about, you know, we hate both parties, and, well...
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do you go with that? I mean, you're a marginalized element, at least far extreme leftists are. We should recognize that we're marginalized, and that you know, the left by itself can't go nose to nose and beat this domestic terrorism focused right. At least that's the way I look at it. And you know, so you have to make peace with the deep state. You know, and if we can check the, you know, right-wing domestic terrorism, you know, and then we deal with the deep state. You know, then we on the left have to focus on the deep state. Fortunately, it won't eat us alive. I don't know if all of this makes sense, but I was trying to explain some of this to somebody yesterday, and he's looking at me like I was out of my mind. But maybe I am. I don't know. But
no.
I think what Michael Moore's, the can of worms that he's opening there is very interesting.
Well, he here's a little more of it. He goes, and I don't want to read it all because it's very long.
Mm-hmm, true. Yeah. Hello. Mike? Hello.
No, it's okay. Are you still there? Hello?
Hey, Mike. Yeah, we fell off the boat.
Don't hang up,
fell off,
man.
The boat here or something.
I fell off the boat. I don't know what happened. My phone hung up on me. Never hang up the boat, buddy, or hang up the mic, man. We got 12 minutes.
Oh,
shit. Yeah. Well, so back to Michael Moore's Insurrectionist Envy, which I thought was a great title.
Yeah.
And he did, it's not like he doesn't want anything. He says, he's very clever.
He's
a fundraiser. He says, give a subscription. He says, help Mike enrich uranium. You hit the button and it takes you to a fundraiser. Help Mike enrich uranium. That's obviously it.
Yeah, Michael Moore didn't get where he is as a national figure by being shy about fundraising or all that kind of thing. He's a very smart guy.
Yeah, he points out that in the summer of 2020, we showed the world the largest nationwide demonstrations ever, and the murderous cop was sent to prison, and Trump was sent packing. And then what? Question mark. So all we have left to do is throw Steve Bannon in jail. And then we can get back to the real fight of recycling pop bottles, putting solar panels on our roof, and whatever else our environmental leader Mike Bloomberg and Sierra Club tell us to do, question mark. Because we all know deep down the fix is in, our democracy is in shreds. Black lives don't really matter, and it's too late now to stop planet Earth from spinning off into the sunset of its demise because we ignored the real radical environmentalists and the teenage student from Sweden, and went with the sellouts instead. All this because we secretly admire how the right fight wins, stands their ground, and never backs down, even when they know there are far many more of us than there are of them. They don't care. This is their country.
Right, but they deem we are pushovers. And because they have the guns and they're the tough guys and they reinforce each other with all their macho stuff, that they can prevail. And if you look around the world, they have a good case. You look at violence in Mexico, virtually areas of Mexico are simply ungovernable because the drug gangs are so exceedingly violent that, you know, they rule. They just rule the roost. There's nothing you can do about it. Now, once, you know, that's reinforced, it just tends to expand. And so, to me, the fulcrum of all this is the idea of violence. What do you do about that? So I think the left has to be ready for an open sort of metaphor here, to take a punch. We have to learn how to take a punch, because violence is just simply the way of the world in the 21st century. You know, it finds its place. It's not like, you know, we don't have huge moving armies anymore. We violence tends to be, like everything else, atomized and fragmented, because of the breakdown with the internet and everything. There is a certain envy of that attitude. In other words, why can't we put Donald Trump in jail? Why can't we put Steve Bannon in jail? What is it that, you know, I think the hearing, what do you call it, January 6th hearing.
Select committee.
I think they're very wise the way they're going about it. They're very frustrating. My wife is like every night, like, where the hell are they? Why aren't they doing this? They should do this. They should send them. They should do the, you know, send them in jail, put them away, knock them off, you know. And they seem to be doing nothing. They had that opening gambit where they had the four cops, and then it seems they went to sleep for a couple of months, you know. But I don't think they were going to sleep. I think they were really trying to figure it out. They lost two rounds to this, you could say sort of this idea of envying the right, you know, their inability to be touched by any of this. It's obvious that you can't. So they're going to do it differently. With two impeachments, they lost two impeachments. You know, you go into these impeachments, we all on the left thought, well, they got them nailed. And, of course, they didn't.
Yeah.
He slipped away both times. And the guy did say, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And then you wonder, well, what is it? Why is it? Again, it's to me. In some sense, there's nothing new here. You know, we as an anti-war activist for 40 years plus or something. This attitude is not new. I mean, violence is in America.
Well, as
H. Rapp Brown said, as it's American as apple or cherry pie.
You've already loaded the deck. I mean, by being anti-war. You necessarily associated with a large number of pacifists, religious or otherwise, and are you going to deny the anti-war movement has a large number of pacifists in it?
This is making my case. Right, you're right. I mean.
I'm not against pacifism. You know, I'm not.
Gandhi was very effective, but as many people say, Gandhi was not always purely Gandhian. You know, he did. You know,
I don't know enough. I mean, just about him and King.
Well, like
he
worked on an ambulance during World War One when was part of the combatants. He was a partisan anyway.
Oh, that doesn't count, especially when you're driving an ambulance.
That's bullshit.
I mean, I get that this nonviolent thing rammed down my throat for years. I've had that.
Sure.
And I don't mind it. I just like, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we gotta, but I'm not gonna organize the first demonstration to march people into machine guns. I'm just not gonna do that.
I'm not gonna be responsible. Yeah, I'm not gonna.
It may come down to that. That may be the only way it comes down. Literally, 100, 200, 500 people killed in a single day. I mean, Kent State was only 13, I think. I can't remember how many were shot. Four were killed. I saw the living, breathing result of that in Kansas. The campus, the Kansas University campuses were shut down immediately. People just refused to go to school. The university system shut down after Kent State and Jackson State, by the way, and it did have an effect. I mean, ROTC suddenly was no longer on campus. You know, on the University of Kansas in Lawrence, I mean, it was more of an underground organization. Then after that, for years and years after that, and you know, it's just, I saw it happening, but that was nothing less than fear. The chancellor, the university, the alumni, the big money people that run the sports programs—they were all in fear. You know, the demonstration, the anti-war movement.
That's the crux of it. That's the crux of it.
Yeah.
Once violence breaks out, you know, it could be absurd violence. It made no sense. But the point is, people get so scared and so, you know, terrified of breaking out violence, they then allow much more repressive governments, you know, in order to save their sorry asses. So this is why I say, you know, the left. I mean, it's easy to sit here in my comfortable living room and say this, but, you know, the left needs to be able to take a punch, you know, and be able to absorb some of this violence and come back, keep their eyes on the prize and all that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, what Michael Moore's talking about is a very real phenomenon, you know, that why is it that, you know, the right can get away with this stuff? And, you know, because, I mean, everybody on the Republican side is dismissing January 6th as if it was, like, ridiculous. It was nothing.
Right.
It was just tourists,
yeah.
You know, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, of course, everybody who witnessed it could see that's ridiculous, but even it's ridiculous, it still gets traction, you know what I mean? The ridiculous gets traction in this realm. It's just interesting to mull over. Yeah.
Yeah, well, here's something to mull over, listeners. There's a new article out by a guy named Hunter Walker, who's a freelancer. He's not on staff at the Oregon publication. The Rolling Stone printed it. Just Google Rolling Stone Hunter Walker, and it'll take you to the article that he wrote just 2 days ago. And in answer to your Luann's misgivings and listeners, I think the House Select Committee is doing something. To be very quick, because this article has caused a landslide of speculation or whatever among the mainstream media and the left and right media, because it details Mr. Walker's article details that there's two for sure and a third that he's willing to talk about who are talking to the committee and naming names. And it's it.
Yeah.
And the one guy, Gomer, I call him Gomer. You know, that
yeah,
guy,
Gomer,
the,
Congressman Gomer. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a piece of work.
Well, the hot news is that out of the hotel command center, the war room, Steve Bannon and John Eastman and Rudy
Gomer.
Giuliani were all there all the time, and all their staff members, and at the what was the goddamn name of the hotel we were laughing about?
Willard,
the Willard Hotel. Yeah, they got it. Mr. Hunter Walker has it down at Rolling Stone. They're rolling over and talking, naming names, and Gomer was running in promising blanket pardons for everybody. And we're running out of time, but I want to get this last end, John.
Mm-hmm.
It's the important part. They were already, and you can see it on your videos. Just look at your videos of the January 6th. They were already new. Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and other far-right groups were all around the Willard Hotel that night, outside the hotel, inside the hotel. And they knew that when Donald Trump started his speech to head out, the proof of this is that you can look at the times they were already breaking barricades down while minutes before Donald Trump finished his. So they were already en route to the place to cause the riot. So I think people are, as usual, they're spilling their guts, John Grant. I think
they should read the Rolling Stone piece. Very important. And also there's an HBO has a 2-hour documentary that was quite good. I saw it tonight. You know, so they're peeling the onion layers back on January 2nd. Well, it's HBO. It's a documentary on it, and it the most impressive one was they got some of these, like Galgos is a congressman, and he was a Iraq vet. I'll make this really quick. But he was asked later, this was a year or 6 months later, you know, what were you thinking? Well, I was thinking, you know, I've been and seen some shit in Iraq. I was thinking I was going to get a pen, a sharp object, and if they came in here, I was going to stab one of them in the eye and in the neck real quick and take his weapon. This is a U.S. congressman who's saying this is what was going through my mind when this shit was happening. And I could say, yep, I can see that, you know. So, you know, don't tell me this was tourists, you know. I mean, there's guys with guns holding them back in the House of Representatives, you know.
But, we got to close it down. That's a good way to close the show. John Grant, thank you.
Take care, Mike. See you later. Bye-bye.